James Callaghan takes over as British Prime Minister. Stocks in the New York Exchange close higher in heavy trading. The editor of the 4 o'clock report, William Buckley. Roger Skibben is reporting this afternoon for Lyle Vann. Our next news as it happens. Next scheduled news at 4:30 with Lester Smith right here over WOR. Next over WOR, your friends and mine, Bob and Ray.
Thank you, Roger, and hello again, everybody. Greet you on this brand new week here in April. And we have a full program arranged for you today, too.
Yes, sir, and we have a big surprise next week, too.
Oh,
indeed, a week from today. Well, I can't say what it is, but it'll be well worth your being tuned in.
Really a big surprise?
Oh, yeah.
It's not a put-on now.
No. If it had been a put-on, it would have been last week.
All right.
First.
Okay, once again, we've had our scouts combing the railroad and bus stations around New York in search of people who are, well, more or less down on their luck. We always enjoy hearing their pathetic stories and then giving them a helping hand from our generous Bob and Ray organization. So why don't we get started by talking to that creature there with you at the microphone, Bob, if you would.
Okay, this is Mrs. Letty Wilch of North Platte, Nebraska. Ladies and gentlemen, Ms. Wilch, welcome. According to your card, you suffered heartbreak after coming here to New York to further your education. Would you tell us about it?
Yes, that's right. I saw a magazine ad placed by a school here in the city. It told how wealthy I could become as a trained bulldozer operator.
Uh-huh.
So I spent my life savings to come to New York and enroll.
Well, choosing a career in bulldozing shows a lot of ambition for a rather large, middle-aged woman like yourself,
yeah.
But I assume it didn't work out, huh?
No, I guess I just didn't get as much training as I needed. The school didn't have a real bulldozer, so they taught me, or taught all of us, I should say, by using a toy bulldozer made for kids. And when I went out for my first job interview, I really wasn't prepared.
Yeah, they tell me you accidentally put your prospective employer's bulldozer in reverse and knocked over his construction office, huh?
That's right. The toy one we used at school didn't have any of those gears and things, so I just pulled one at random and did about $10,000 worth of damage.
Well, sure, it would normally take a person like you a lifetime to pay off that debt, but
sure.
Thanks to our generous Bob and Ray organization, you're going to enjoy an expense-paid two-week vacation in sunny Ecuador.
Well, I can't go on a vacation. Now, I have to make regular payments to that construction company or they'll have me thrown in the clink.
All right, don't try to thank us, Ms. Wilch. Helping you is our pleasure, and it's a great way to start a week. Now, moving along to our next pathetic specimen with a hard luck story to tell. Meet Mr. Otto Hoovnern of Nitro, West Virginia. You came to New York, Mr. Hoovnern, in a desperate effort to find food for your family, is that right?
Yes, I guess you could say that. Me and the wife and kids are all crazy about pizza, but there's no place back there in Nitro where you can get it. So I had to spend quite a bit on a trip to New York.
Well, I'm afraid that's not quite the same story you told our scouts before you went on the air. You said your children were going hungry.
Well, they were hungry. You don't think I'd come 400 miles to get a pizza if they weren't even hungry, do you?
Well, I guess it was just a misunderstanding on both sides. Now, let's have a nice butane lighter for you from our generous Bob and Ray organization. That's for your troubles.
A lighter? I let a pizza get cold in the back of my car while I hang around this place for an hour and you give me a cheap lighter? Boy, talk about nervy people.
Don't try to thank us, sir. Now, moving along to our last hard luck victim, here's Mrs. Fern Meltzer of Bath, Maine. Quite obvious that you've come to New York for emergency treatment, Mrs. Meltzer.
Well, I don't think it was as obvious as all that. It's just a matter of my incisor teeth here in front having grown a little too long.
The other upper ones come clear down to your chin. In fact, they look more like fangs than human teeth.
Well, I guess they do give me a rather frightening appearance if you don't know that I'm really mild-mannered.
Mm.
But I'm hoping children will stop running from me in panic once I scrape up enough money to have the necessary dental work done.
Oh, that's really a shortage of funds that's prevented you from getting rid of this grotesque appearance of yours.
Yes, I used to make a good living as a social director at a resort hotel in Maine. Then I started scaring the guests so badly that my employer had to give me the old, what they call, heave-ho.
Well, it's easy to understand why you haven't been able to get another job to finance your dental work. Now, as a token of our sympathy, our generous Bob and Ray organization wants you to have this lovely, chrome-plated, professional-quality harmonica.
Well, I can't play a harmonica with front teeth like this. In fact, I can only take nourishment through a straw.
Quite all right. I'm sure you'll have a lot of enjoyment out of it. And now, back over to Ray at our main anchor desk.
Backstage, noble wife. the story of America's favorite family of the footlights and of their fight for security and happiness against the concrete heart of Broadway. At La Scala Opera House in Milan, the opening performance of La Traviata. His Mary is on stage singing Addio del Passato as Harry, Calvin, and Pop await their entrance cues backstage. And we hear...
She's doing pretty good.
Certainly is.
And she can read the cards, obviously, because she hasn't missed a word yet, you know.
Yeah, but the only problem is they've got the third act cards up for her, and this is only the first act.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
That's liable to throw the whole story off.
You know what threw the whole thing off?
No.
You telling Mary to break her leg. Because one of the stagehands told me a few moments ago you should say in Boca Lupo.
In Boca Lupo?
Means something about the mouth of the wolf.
Oh, it's different here, then.
Kind of like a deja vu thing.
Yeah, no, it isn't anything to do with
deja vu. No, it's nothing like deja vu.
No, I wouldn't think it was.
Well, I thought it might be.
In other words, they say something about a wolf here instead of breaking your leg like they do at home.
That's right. They say you're in the mouth of the wolf, which is, of course, no place to be. Like deja vu.
Do you get any... It's nothing like deja vu.
Like deja vu at all.
Do you get any reaction from the audience at all?
Boy, that was a good... Here comes the curtain.
There was not supposed to be a curtain at this spot in the opera, but... Mary!
Yes?
Oh, you sang your heart out. Beautiful.
Well, those cards are upside down. They had the wrong act and everything. I just had to live my way through it. Well, I had to really fake it.
Well, where's Greg? Maybe he can straighten up.
He's out in that little thing out where the
prompter's box?
Yes. His face is out there as big as all daylight.
Has he got that bottle of wine with him?
I kicked him right in the nose holding up those wrong cards for me.
Has he got the bottle of wine with him?
That's another thing. He looks like he's smashed. And that's no place to be smashed, sitting there in the prompter's little box.
Is he telling the cue card boys when to come on and hold the card? Oh, wait a minute. Here's Greg. Greg.
Yeah.
The curtain came down in the middle of Act One there with Mary singing the third
act
song.
I gave the cue. I told them to ring it down. It was a mistake. They'll ring it back up in a minute.
Uh-huh.
Yes, sir. Hey, how you doing?
Why, all right, Greg.
I'm doing fine.
Boy.
How are you doing?
Oh, you don't look too good, Mr. Barlow.
Right. I sure don't look so good, do I?
Oh, I think we've got problems here. How are we going to straighten this opera out?
You look like you've been there before, kind of like a deja vu, isn't it?
No, it isn't anything like that.
No, it's not like deja vu.
Nothing like deja vu.
No way.
Hey, Mary, that was good. The only criticism I'd have...
What is that?
...is that it was, you know, you're singing the wrong song in the wrong act.
And so it begins to look as if our friends have problems as the production of La Traviata moves ahead in Milan. And you ought to be here tomorrow when we'll hear Mary say...
Your turn to go on now.
That's tomorrow in the next exciting episode of Mary Backstage, Noble Wife. Word Carr speaking. Now, the makers of Tingle, the long-wearing dental floss made of spun glass fiber, invite you to join us for another exciting adventure of Elmer W. Litzinger, Spy.
My name is Elmer W. Litzinger, Spy. I handle some of the toughest espionage assignments our government can hand out. Recently, I was dispatched to the capital city of an unfriendly country. My job was to coordinate the activities of our undercover agents there. So, without arousing suspicion, I took a cab to the leading hotel in town and confronted the desk clerk.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Can I help you?
Well, I certainly hope so. One of your local cab drivers just charged me 25 glockmas for a ride from the airport. I'm afraid I'll go broke taking taxis to all the addresses on this list here when I don't know my way around town. Can you tell me which ones are close by so that I could walk to them?
Well, let's see. This is a very interesting list you've got. I notice that most of these people live under manholes and in secret passageways behind coal bins.
Yes, but I hope that doesn't give you the idea that my associates are bums. They just have to keep out of sight because they're engaged in espionage work. You see, my true name happens to be Elmer W. Litzinger, spy.
Oh, pleased to meet you. My true name is Vladimir Klinko, night clerk. I think maybe I can help you work out a way to hit all these spots. course, I'll have to copy down the names and addresses so I can study them for a while.
Oh, I hate to put you to all that trouble. You could make copies of all the pages easily with this secret camera I have here in my lapel button. But then, of course, we'd have to wait for the film to come back from the drugstore.
No, I can take care of that in a jiffy. My friends in the Ministry of Information would be happy to make several copies of a document like this while I wait.
Well, that certainly would be convenient. Just let me cross off this name here at the top of the list first. He's been called back to Washington because he wasn't feeling well.
Oh, okay. And you can cross off the next name, too. He was feeling so bad, the police had to send him out of town for a long rest.
Oh, really? I'm sorry to hear that. But it was kind of the officers to look after him. He didn't have any friends here in the city at all.
He still doesn't. Right now, nobody knows that better than he does. Incidentally, this address at the bottom must be a mistake. 238 East Avenue of the Revolution is a vacant lot.
Yes, I know. Stuyvesant's been pretty clever about that. He dug a comfortable chamber for himself under a big rock right there in the middle.
Is that so?
Yeah.
I had some friends who were hunting all over town for Stuyvesant. No wonder they never found him.
Well, all of our people try to maintain a low profile, like Lindblad over here on the next page. That address I have for him is a small, inconspicuous Chinese laundry. But in the back room, he's got all the printing equipment he needs to make phony identification papers that look exactly like the real thing.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Let me make a note of that. My friends are especially interested in dropping by to see people like him.
Well, then I'm sure they'd want to meet Claiborne. Now, he's the head of our whole operation in this country. He lives in an attic above a warehouse at this address. Nobody even knows there's a room in there.
Well, confidentially, somebody does know the room is there, and that's why Claiborne doesn't live in it anymore.
Oh?
He's taken up residence in our hall of interrogation across town.
Well, that's a more vital bit of data than you could possibly realize. You see, if he's moved into a nicer place, that means he's finished his assignment and come out of hiding. So there's no need for me to take a cab clear across town just to see him. I can simply file a report with my home office saying, "Mission completed," by Elmer W. Litzinger. Spy.
This is the story of a marvelous little pear-shaped tomato.
Do I know her?
No. I'm being serious. These are the special pear-shaped Montini tomatoes they peel so carefully and flavor with basil leaves.
What's with this basil leaf?
Well, that makes them Italian style.
Well, what's wrong with nice, round, plump tomatoes?
Oh, they're fine, too, especially if they're Montini. But for SSS customers, we have this true Italian kind by Montini.
What's SSS?
That's a spaghetti sauce sophisticate.
Ah.
The real pasta sauce expert. The cook who wouldn't think of starting a sauce with anything less than Montini Italian-style pear-shaped tomatoes.
I'll buy that.
I knew you would. And so did Montini.
And making a great Italian sauce always begins with Montini Italian-style plum-peeled tomatoes. Plump, solid, and packed with fresh basil leaf right in the can. Look for Montini.
1 and 2 and...
8 o'clock. 9 o'clock. 9:45. You keep me waiting till it's getting aggravating. You're a slow poke. I wait and worry, but you never seem to hurry. You're a slow poke. Time means nothing to you. I wait and then late again. 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 9:45. Why should I linger every time you snap your finger, little slow poke? Why can't you hasten when you see the time's a-wasting? You're a slow poke, dear. Why should I keep trying to change you? It's not the thing to do. I guess I'll have to learn to be a slow poke, too. Just a slow poke. Slow as molasses. Eight o'clock, 9 o'clock,
afford it. What'd you do, take a shampoo?
Why should I linger every time you snap your finger, little slow poke? Why can't you hasten when you see the time's a waste and you're a slow poke? Why should I keep trying to change you? It's not the thing to do. I guess I'll have to learn to be a slow poke, a slower slow poke than my little slow poke. I guess I'll have to learn to be a slow poke too.
That was fun. Off the chorus. With Slowpoke.
Boy, when is how far back does that go?
I have no
40s?
Idea.
40s? Is it late 40s or 50? 50.
Yeah, that was really great.
Oh, that was wonderful. You know, traditionally, we've only had two choices when it came to coffee, regular and decaffeinated. Welcome you again to our popular Bob and Ray public service feature, Widen Your Horizons, portion of the show where we help you acquire new skills for leading a fuller, happier life. Today, our guest lecturer is Mr. Tebley Boatman of the Old Faithful Soap and Detergent Company. His informative talk is entitled, How to Wash Your Hands. Welcome, Mr. Boatman.
Thank you.
I admit we had a few reservations about inviting you to be with us today. You know, I didn't have any idea so many Americans needed basic instruction on how to wash their hands.
Well, of course, that gets us into a definition of terms. You're Mr. Elliott, right?
Yes,
well, most people know how to turn on a water faucet and run their hands under it real fast.
Uh-huh.
But we refer to that as rinsing, not washing.
Rinsing?
Yes.
Well, I suppose you don't approve of simple rinsing since you're with a soap and detergent company, huh?
Well, it's really not a question of approving or disapproving. Personally, I think a fast rinse under the faucet is okay if you just have a couple of smudged fingers to take care of, but you can run into real trouble when the hands are caked with the grimy dirt.
Uh-huh.
Some experts think the only cure for that is taking a complete bath, but I favor hand washing.
Well, of course, a bath wastes a lot of hot water, and sometimes we're trying to save the energy involved,
sure,
in it, so the national interest is involved to an extent.
Well, yes, that's very true. And then there's the matter of guest towels. There's nothing worse than giving grimy hands a plain water rinse and then wiping them on a guest towel.
That's right. I've seen
it. That may even contribute to our high divorce rate.
Well, I don't know whether we'd go so far as to say that, but there certainly is a great need for your lecture, Mr. Boatman. I will agree. Why don't you just begin? I see you brought a basin of water along with you there.
Yes, it was kind of hard to carry it over here on the bus, too, but I wasn't sure you had running water in this building, so I brought my own. Of course, it should be mentioned to anyone following along with me at home that you just don't plunge your hands into the wash basin.
No.
You have to roll up your sleeves first, like this.
All right. Now, let me just kind of describe what you're doing. Mr. Boatman is unbuttoning one of his cuffs and... The right cuff. He's folding the material all the way around. It's about a 3-inch fold you've made in there, isn't it, sir?
Yes, I'd say it's about 3 inches. Whatever the width of the cuff happens to be, I always turn that back first and then just keep making additional folds until both sleeves are rolled up to the elbow.
That's a good way. And then you're all ready to stick your hands in the water without getting any of your clothing wet, right?
Well, your clothing may be safe, but you're not ready or near ready to stick your hands in the water yet.
No?
You should also check to see if the bar of soap you plan to use is a new one that hasn't been unwrapped yet. Taking the paper off after your hands are already wet can be a very tedious job.
Oh, yes, I've had that experience. The wrapper seems to get kind of slippery when you try to rip it off with wet hands.
Well, actually, it's the soap inside that gets slippery when it's exposed to moisture. That tends to transfer over to the paper wrapper, and then all of a sudden everything is slippery.
Well, I'd really never analyzed how it happens, but I know it can be a problem, so... You unwrap the soap while your hands are still dry, and then are you ready to wash?
No, not quite. We also recommend that you take your phone off the hook. You know, having it ring while you're washing your hands is very undesirable. So I'll just lift off the phone receiver here.
Well, we don't get any incoming calls on that one. When we're on the air, if you want to use it for demonstration purposes, that's fine, I guess. Now, are you ready to wash?
Not quite. If you're at home, you should next go into the kitchen and smell for leaking gas. Now, you may also want to let the cat out. And if it looks like rain, close the windows. In other words, try to anticipate anything that might happen to interrupt you while you're washing. And then, slowly, slide your hands into the washbowl, palms up.
That's to prevent water from splashing on the floor, I suppose.
That's right. Just slide them in slowly and naturally. There's no need to rush because you've thought of everything beforehand. Mm. Oh, for the love of Pete, look what I did. I forgot to take my wristwatch off.
Well, maybe I can reach in there and unfasten it.
No, it's too late now. There's already a lot of moisture under the crystal. The works inside are soaked. It's a $400 watch, too.
Well, I'm awfully sorry.
You're sorry? It's the third wristwatch I've ruined this week. My employer won't even compensate me for the loss. I tell you, I really had it with this lousy job. I quit.
You've been listening to an informative lecture by Mr. Tebley Boatman, entitled How to Wash Your Hands. We invite you to join us again soon when you'll have an opportunity to learn another valuable new skill on our next session of Widen Your Horizons.
New Jersey Senate puts off income tax vote for a month. Two die in Alaska plane landing accident. That's the 5 o'clock report. Harry Hennessy sitting in for John Scott. Next scheduled news at 5:30 on WOR Radio 710, The Talk of New York. Now more Bob and Radio New York.
And welcome again to This Place for Heroes, dramatizing events in the lives of ordinary citizens who've dared to fight against evil without giving thought to their own personal safety. Today's reenactment tells the story of small-town shopkeeper Willard Clutie and his determined struggle to make his community a decent place in which to live. And we'll be meeting the real Willard Clutie right after our factually documented dramatization.
Willard, for heaven's sake, put your hand down. You don't have any reason to get up there and talk at the town meeting. And none of these people want to hear you anyway.
I don't care whether they want to hear me or not, Lucille. It's time somebody around here got up at a town meeting and spoke the truth. Police Chief Higgins is a bully and a crook. But he's got everybody else so terrified they're afraid to talk.
Well, I'd say they're terrified with good reason, Willard. Chief Higgins has 27 deputies on the force now, and those ruffians just aren't going to take any guff from a little twerp like you.
Those deputies are all Higgins' relatives, Lucille, and they're running this town into bankruptcy with their graft and corruption. They must be stopped, and I'm going to do it.
The chair is called for new business, and I see Willard Clutie's hand out there, so you can come up and pay tribute to the present administration for a few minutes, Willard.
Mr. Chairman, I don't need to come up there to say what I want these people to hear. And I'm certainly not paying tribute to the present administration. All we've got in this town administration is one wishy-washy mayor and 28 crooked cops.
Clutie, you're out of order. Sit down and be quiet.
No, we've all done that too long. Now I call upon my fellow citizens to face the truth. Is there any legitimate reason why a peaceful town of 200 people needs 28 policemen? I say no. It's all graft and corruption. We've just been too afraid of Higgins and his bullies to stand up to them.
That's enough, Cody. I'm warning you.
Yes, I guess I have said enough. I've blown the lid off the whole crooked business. Now that my fellow citizens have seen that I'm not afraid to speak out against corruption, they'll join me in helping to keep this town clean. The great tidal wave of reform has begun here tonight, and I'm proud to have been the one who started the movement to make this community a decent place in which to live.
Two full years have now passed since Willard Clutie dared to stand up at the town meeting and point the finger of guilt at corrupt leaders of local government. And since then, great changes have taken place in his community. And to tell you that closing chapter of our story, we're going to bring on, right now, the real Willard Clutie. Mr. Clutie.
Sorry, I couldn't move any faster. I still haven't gotten the knack of pushing myself around in a wheelchair, even after all this time.
Well, I would have given you a hand, sir, but I didn't know you had both legs in a cast also. Were you in an auto accident?
No, not originally. That's kind of what it developed into. First, I was just stopped by Police Chief Higgins back home for driving with one taillight burned out. And then he got on the radio and called for about 15 of his deputies to assist him. And while I was allegedly resisting arrest, my car happened to roll off a cliff with me in it.
Well, I don't see how your car could roll off a cliff while you were just being stopped for a traffic ticket. Could you explain that?
No, I really couldn't. I've been told to keep my mouth shut about the whole thing, or my next accident will be a lot worse.
Well, it's with typical modesty and courage that you're declining to talk about the physical pain you must be suffering at this very moment. And it's that character trait which has made you a hero, Willard Clooney, the very kind of hero we're proud to honor here on this place for heroes.
And now, the American Federation of Sheep Herders, representing 14,000 lonely people like yourself, brings you another episode of The Gathering Dusk, the heartwarming story of a girl who's conquered unhappiness by surrendering to it completely. As we look in on the Bessinger household today, Edna is feeding table scraps to the goldfish in the downstairs parlor. It's late afternoon, and Mr. Hergenzweig, the regional director of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, is just arriving.
Oh, it's you, Bureau of Indian Affairs Regional Director Hergenzweig. I hope I didn't ask you to come rushing over here on one of your tribal holidays. I suppose I could have held out until tomorrow if you were celebrating somewhere.
No, I was perfectly free to come over today, Miss Bessinger. I don't think this is any sort of tribal holiday. Of course, I'm not an Indian myself, anyway.
Well, you certainly don't look like it with those blue eyes and blonde hair. Besides, I never heard of an Indian named Hergenzweig. What tribal language does that come from?
Well, it's not an Indian name at all, ma'am. It's German.
Is that a fact? I never realized the Germans were Indians. I was even laboring under the illusion that quite a few of them live in Germany.
Well, that's not an illusion, Miss Bessinger. Almost all the Germans live in Germany.
I see. Well, when are you going back there?
Well, I'm not going back there at all. In fact, I've never been there. I just have a German name. My ancestors came from Germany.
Do tell. I could have sworn I read someplace that the ancestors of our modern Indians came from Northern Asia. I'll bet the professors at the State University will be amazed when I write to tell them that we have an Indian right here in the village whose ancestors rode their ponies over here from Germany.
Well, I don't think you should write that to anybody, Miss Bessinger. I keep telling you, I'm not an Indian.
I thought you were telling me you aren't a German. You're just an Indian with a German name.
No, ma'am. I have a German name, and I work for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, but I'm not a German or an Indian.
Oh, heavens to Betsy, that must create an awful lot of confusion for you.
No, never created any at all till a few minutes ago. But I don't suppose my family background is what you call me over here to talk about anyway.
No, that was just a brief exchange of pleasantries, Bureau of Indian Affairs Regional Director Hergenzweig. Actually, I've been in a state of complete panic all day ever since I first saw that new totem pole the Indians have put up near the corner. I can't seem to find anything in my encyclopedia that tells whether the tribe that worships totem poles is friendly or warlike.
Well, to answer your question in the best way I can, Miss Bessinger, I don't know what you're talking about because there aren't any Indians around here. In fact, the only reason we have a local office of the Bureau of Indian Affairs is that nobody in Washington remembered to close it 100 years ago.
Well, that's an interesting little boondoggle you've got going, but I really can't give it my full attention just now. I can see that totem pole right out the window, and it looks terribly ominous to me. The figure on top has that wild expression in its eyes and all that stringy hair. I'll bet anything it's a warlike symbol.
Well, I see what you're pointing at now, Miss Bessinger. I assure you it's not a symbol at all. It's just a telephone pole that you probably couldn't see from this window until the Fergusons chopped down that tree in their side yard.
Oh, land sakes, I do believe you're right, Bureau of Indian Affairs Regional Director Hergenzweig. And I'll bet that that long, stringy hair is really just a lot of wires stretching over to another pole. I wondered what strange sort of ritual was going on this morning when I saw two tribal leaders in overalls arrive in a telephone truck, and shinny up the pole. But now the mysterious events all fit together perfectly, and I can feel my panic starting to subside. It's almost as if I'm no longer standing in the gathering dusk.
Can it be that Edna's freedom from fear of warlike Indians in the neighborhood may at last enable her to find true happiness? Or will it only lead to further heartbreak when she realizes that a marauding band of telephone linemen can be much more dangerous? Be sure to join us for the next exciting episode when Edna may have her wagons form a circle to hold off the invaders in the gathering dusk.
You know the last...
The makers of Einbinder Flypaper, a name you've gradually grown to trust over the course of three generations, invite you to ride with the men of Squad Car 119.
My name's Sam Finch. Me and my partner, Ralph R. Kruger Jr., were the unsung heroes of the police force. We ride a prowl car at night. Part of the year, we go to work on standard time. Part of the year, it's daylight saving. Either way, we keep on the lookout for trouble. The other evening, we just gotten back into the squad car after stopping to buy a newspaper, when my partner, Ralph R. Kruger Jr., turned to me and said,
"Well, what do you know about that, Sam? Henderson out in the Valley Division got his picture in the paper for climbing a tree to rescue a kitten."
"Is that right? I don't know Henderson out in the Valley Division, Ralph R. Jr."
"Sure you do, Sam. He sat right next to us last year at the seminar on fingerprinting."
"Well, I didn't go to a seminar on fingerprinting last year, Ralph R."
"Sure you did, Sam. You sat on one side of me, and Henderson from out in the Valley Division sat on the other side."
"No, I wasn't there. I was home with a cold."
"Oh, maybe you're right, Sam. I guess it was Henderson from out in the Valley Division on one side of me, and Aldrich from the Wilshire Division on the other side."
"That could be. Aldrich from the Wilshire Division told me he was there. I'm acquainted with Aldrich."
"Well, he doesn't look anything like Henderson from out in the Valley Division, Sam. I sure don't see how you could get them mixed up."
"Well, it's just one of those common mistakes."
"Calling Car 119, Car 119. Investigate a shooting in progress at 8402 West Robertson. A shooting at 8402 West Robertson."
"Huh, shooting at 8402 West Robertson, huh?"
"That's us, Sam. Let's roll."
"Yeah, I guess we better. Sure hate to drive over in that neighborhood, though. Never any place on the street to park."
"I know what you mean, Sam. A lot of times you circle around for half an hour just looking for a spot."
"Yeah, this job shouldn't take long, though. Maybe I could double park and wait in the car while you handle the complaint."
"Well, it's not just a complaint, Sam. It's a shooting in progress. I think maybe we should both get in."
"Well, I don't see why, Ralph R. Jr. Shooting doesn't even take as long as handling a complaint. I could double park and wait in the car easy."
"Well, I know your part would be easy that way, Sam, but then I get the whole other part, so I think we should both go in."
"No, really. I don't mind waiting in the car, Ralph R. Jr. Take as long as you like."
"Well, it's not that I want to take long, Sam. I just think we should both go in."
"Well, maybe we should, I suppose."
"Car 119, Car 119, disregard that call to investigate a shooting in progress at 8402 West Robertson. The case has been handled by the men of Squad Car 237. The suspect has been apprehended, booked, and brought to trial. In 1 minute, the results of that trial."
And while we wait to hear the outcome of today's exciting case, here's an important shopping reminder from the makers of Einbinder Flypaper. Friends, how long has it been since you checked the supply of flypaper in your storage cabinet? It could be running dangerously low, and right now is the best time to visit your local supplier while you can still get there. Be sure to tell them you want genuine Einbinder flypaper, the brand you've gradually grown to trust over the course of three generations. Do it today.
The suspect involved in that shooting in progress on Robertson was convicted on one count of taking part in a shooting and two counts of doing it while the shooting was in progress. He has now served 6 years of a 3-year prison sentence due to clerical misplacing of his release papers.
And so another desperate criminal is brought to justice thanks to the unsung heroes of the police force, the men who ride the squad cars at night.
And now the news here at WOR New York and RKO General Station.
House passes flu inoculation bill, 2 killed in Alaska airliner crash, and Britain gets a new prime minister. The temperature reading now in clear midtown Manhattan, 57 degrees. And good evening, everyone. This is the WOR News, the 6 o'clock report. And this is Roger Skibinus reporting for Lyle Vann. Per hour, the barometer 29.81 and rising. The lead stories: House passes bill authorizing nationwide immunization program against swine influenza. Two persons killed in crash of airliner with 49 persons aboard at Ketchikan, Alaska. The editor for the news at 6, Walter Troy Spencer, Roger Skibinus, substituting for Lyle Vann over WOR Radio 710, The Talk of New York. Our next news at 6:30 with Lester Smith. Now it's 6:15. Now it's time for Bob and Ray.
And at this time, we present another in a continuing series of Bob and Ray editorial opinions. These editorials are issued by the Bob and Ray Public Affairs Department. Speaking on behalf of Bob and Ray Organization, Bob and myself.
We're always happy to cancel the entertainment portion of our program in order to present these editorial views because we firmly believe that America would be a better place if its people were well informed.
It would also help if they were a lot smarter. But that would be the subject of a whole editorial in itself. And today we wish to turn our attention to another subject that's almost as important. I'm speaking, of course, of the discrimination in our society against short people. We find this situation appalling.
Yes, indeed we do. But in order for you to share our appallment, perhaps we should first define what we mean by short people. Now, we do not include leprechauns, brownies, trolls, or similar groups where shortness is part of the individual's stock and trade.
That would also go for midgets, some of whom make their living by being midgets. And needless to say, we do not include children among the nation's short people. It's true that many children are short, but the vast majority of them will grow taller and thereby escape the discrimination that we're speaking of.
All well and good, you may say. These fine gentlemen have defined the groups they're excluding. But if leprechauns, brownies, trolls, midgets, and children are not the victims of discrimination against short people, then who is? Or, to address it more properly in the plural, who are?
To answer both of those questions, we would like to reply that we're speaking out today on behalf of those fine Americans who stand between 4 feet 10 and 5 feet 2. These are the short people who are so often overlooked.
Often they're overlooked because no one glances down to notice them. But the problem goes deeper than that.
Indeed it does. We would assume that the National Basketball Association is well aware of the fact that hundreds of thousands of young men are shorter than 5 feet 2. And yet the NBA, in almost 30 years of its existence, has never employed one of these little fellows. This, we maintain, is ample proof of job discrimination.
We realize that many among you will say, pish-tosh. So what if short people can't become professional basketball players? Look how many of them are gainfully employed as jockeys. Now, this is true, but we maintain it's not the same thing.
No, it's not the same thing at all. Jockeys ride on horses, and basketball players don't. And there may be other differences, too. But that one alone is adequate to prove our point.
Regrettably, the field of athletics is not the only one in which discrimination against short people exists. There has not been a romantic leading man in Hollywood under 5 feet two since the era of Mickey Rooney.
And if you never considered Mickey Rooney to be a romantic leading man, then the period of discrimination goes back even farther.
Naturally, we've heard all of the standard excuses given by employers for failing to hire short people. Some say they tend to catch cold easily. Others argue that many of them are unkind to animals. You also hear the alibis that they're left-handed, play the harmonica on the job, and show their dishonesty by refusing to look you in the eye.
Our response to those charges is a categorical denial. Short people don't refuse to look you in the eye. They're just not tall enough to look you in the eye. And in addition, many of them are not left-handed. And a few don't even play the harmonica on the job.
Therefore, we urge employers to give short people a break and offer them responsible jobs with small burdens that they'll gladly carry on their little backs. It's the only fair thing to do.
This editorial has been produced by the Bob and Ray Public Affairs Department and does not necessarily represent the opinion of employees of that department. Neither does it represent the opinion of this station or of its advertisers or members of their families.
In fact, we can't think of anybody offhand whose opinion it does represent. And that's one reason why we recognize our responsibility to grant equal time to qualified persons with opposing views.
So if you're a qualified person with an opposing view, think about it. But please don't bother us unless you meet both of those eligibility requirements. You must be a qualified person, and you must have an opposing view. If you're only one of those things, forget it. Thank you.
Yes, especially for forgetting it. Thank you.
Green Point Savings Bank.
Oh.
United States Mint, one of the nation's leading producers of authentic new money, brings you another dramatic story from the files of the Emergency Ward.
Greetings and welcome. I'm Dr. Gerhard Snutten, handsome young physician who has not yet established a practice of his own. Instead, I work in the emergency ward of a big city hospital. The emergency ward is the place where human drama unfolds day and night. Take the other evening, for example, I was checking the results of my latest medical experiment when my assistant nurse, Rudehouse, turned to me and said,
"Why are you sitting there with your shoes and socks off, staring at your feet, doctor?"
"I have reason to believe I've made a significant medical discovery, Nurse Rudehouse. In less than 3 weeks, my toenails have grown considerably, even though the rest of my body has remained the same size for several years now."
"Well, I don't see anything significant about that. I've always assumed that people's toenails keep growing all their lives."
"My point, exactly. You've only assumed that, but I've proved it scientifically. Now, if I can just isolate the hormone that grows toenails, what a boon that would be to short people who've given up hope of getting taller in middle age."
Pardon me, is this the emergency ward of a big city hospital?"
"Yes, it is, and I'm Dr. Gerhard Snutten, handsome young physician who has not yet established a practice of his own. I might also mention that you needn't bring your own folding chair along. We have several in the waiting room that we allow patients to use at a very nominal charge."
"Well, I didn't drag this along because I wanted to, Doc. You see, that's my emergency. The chair collapsed and folded up while I was sitting in it. And now I'm all tangled in the framework here."
"Yes, I notice now that your arms and legs are sticking out at rather peculiar angles. Frankly, I've never had a case before that required cutting a patient into more than two pieces, but looks as if quite a few parts of you'll have to go before you're set free."
"Oh, my stars, doctor. You can't be thinking of anything like that when it would be much easier just to cut up the chair and get them out."
"Nurse Rudehouse, the mere fact that we've established a meaningful relationship off-duty doesn't entitle you to voice an opinion during working hours. I've already noted that the chair frame is made of aluminum. I'd ruin my surgical saw trying to cut through that."
"Well, just because the patient's body is softer material, I don't think that's any reason for going away at him."
"He's obviously going into shock already. Do you have any idea what his condition will be if we wait for an emergency hacksaw to be rushed in from the hardware store?"
"Excuse me, but if you people are planning a long fight, I think I'll go out in the hall for a drink of water."
"Now, don't be gone long. I'll want to give you an anesthetic very shortly. Nurse Rudehouse, call surgery and tell them..."
Hey, look what I did."
"Yes, yes, you've chipped the paint on both sides of the doorway by bumping into it with that confounded chair."
Oh, yeah, I forgot it was attached to me when I tried to go out to the drinking fountain there, but look how it made the chair snap open and turn me loose."
"Well, it's not surprising. If a spring in the mechanism was jammed, bumping the door would cause it to unlock."
"Yeah, you're real bright to think of that. What do I owe you, Doc?"
"Well, repairing that chipped paint could easily run $10.
"Well, okay, here you are, and look, thanks for saving my life. Bye."
"Bye." "Well, Nurse Rudehouse, medical science has again conquered a terrible illness. So you may simply write the entry in your casebook, patient released, cured."
And so ends another tale of heroism in a big city hospital. Join us again soon when the United States Mint, producer of high-quality money, will present still more tense drama from the files of the emergency ward. Thank you, and good night, Stan. We'll see you tomorrow, and that does it for Bob and Ray today.
After the Fort Lewis news commentary that begins in a few seconds, you'll hear WOR Radio Mystery Theater. Tonight it stars Mandel Kramer in a story called Time Killer.
And we'll see you tomorrow at 4:15. Until then, this is Ray Goulding reminding you to write if you get work.
Bob Elliott reminding you to hang by your thumbs.
And this is WOR New York, an RKO General Station.